British racing is running out of road. Falling crowds, shrinking fall crop, and a governance system that's no longer fit for purpose. This week, the Racing Post publishes a special report that asks an urgent question. Is British racing sleepwalking towards a breaking point? Hello and welcome to the front page. This week we publish a special report by ex-jockey Richard Cloran, now working as an equity analyst in the City, that puts in black and white some stark truths facing horse racing. Richard's special report highlights the trends and data points which spell alarm for British racing, and it asks what can be done to put the sport back on a path to growth. To discuss this special report, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by our France correspondent, Scott Burton, and our man in the West Country, James Stevens. Thank you very much for joining us. We're going to dive straight into the big story. I'm going to introduce some of the key data points that Richard raises first of all, because these are the key points that illustrate the challenge that he believes faces British racing. And he looks at four key areas: attendances, betting turnover, the fall crop, and field sizes. On the first, on attendances, Richard spells out that while the top end of British racing has been resilient, below that we have got falling attendances. In fact, flat racing alone has almost a million fewer people attending tracks today than in 2015. And median attendances at leading tracks have all dropped sharply over this period, including 42% down at Ascot, 44% down at Doncaster, and 46% down at Newbury. On betting turnover, until the turn of the decade, Richard shows that turnover on betting on racing barely kept pace with inflation at 2% per annum growth. But since then, betting turnover has fallen from 13.4 billion to 11.8 billion, wiping out 15 years of growth. On the fall crop, Richard quotes a 2023 PwC study that showed the median yearling sale carried a loss of around £33,000, a figure that's been climbing steadily since 2014. And in May, the Thoroughbred Breeders Association found that the fall crop is already running below earlier estimates and could fall a quarter between 2022 and 2026. Finally, on field sizes, average field sizes, which peaked at around 12 runners per race in 2000, have since fallen to 9. And while they have been broadly stable since, the PwC project warned that they could fall to just 7 by 2030, making much of the fixture list unviable. These numbers and more, which are spelled out in Richard's special report, sound existential. Scott, are we in racing in manner's decline, or is this just a crisis that nobody has admitted the scale of yet?
I think the thing that shines through when you read Richard's report is somebody who's taken a really holistic view of the entire industry, the entire sport, and all its disparate elements. So he's looked at the governance structure, he's looked at the fixture list. As you say, he's looked at what breeders are actually producing to source racehorses to fill up the fixture list as well. And when it comes from somebody who knows the sport so well from their first career, mm-hmm. I mean, he's a shining example for Jets. Well, we're giving name checks here, because obviously, you know, he rode for Nicky Anderson. He was a successful jockey and quit at the age of 27, and is now obviously a very, very well respected analyst, investment analyst in the City. But just the thing that shines through over all of this is that each individual element of this, declining betting turnover or declining field sizes, would be worrying, but they're actually all interconnected, and so if one goes, it tends to drag the whole thing down with it. So existential is an easy word to throw around, but it's very, very hard when you read it not to come to the conclusion that there is radical surgery required.
I think that's what's so powerful about this special report, that for the first time, we have seen all these trends pulled together and presented holistically. We've looked at betting turnover, we've looked at attendances, we've looked at the fall crop in the past, but Richard points to a interconnected ecosystem where all the component parts are simultaneously trending in the wrong direction, James.
Yeah, I think it's a game of numbers, a lot of what's in this report, and there are a number of sort of figures and attendance. So for example, flat attendance is down by a million. That's a very interesting point, because we do sometimes are guilty of looking at a Royal Ascot and go, well, racing is thriving. And then you look at the betting turnover. Okay, well, that's great. And as you say, but actually it's that big wider picture where it's not just the headline figures. It's not just the stories that perhaps that are pushed through and the narratives that are pushed through. It's the wider picture. Scott says it is all interconnected. There are lots of different parts, and it's not the biggest surprise what's in this report, because we are always aware of some of these issues. We know about field sizes. We're aware of the challenges of getting people on race courses. We know about the government structure and the frustration. Indeed, it's great to have Lord Allen in. I mean, I remember being here two or three starts ago wondering, when is Lord Allen going to come in? Hooray, he's finally arrived. But there are so many different parts, and it tracks back as well to how we got here in the first place. Because I think what this really underlines for me is the mistakes that have been made in years gone by, is that there is so much power with so many different groups and parties and however you want to define them, and their potential ways of managing their own power has perhaps led to a bigger issue for the wider sport. We've talked in the past about racing needing to come together. I think this clearly spells out why.
Well, let's talk about that, because Richard also diagnoses what's gone wrong. And it points to two key issues: how the sport is funded and how that money is spent. Richard illustrates that just 0.5% of betting turnover in Britain is returned to the sport via the levy, far less in every other country, despite Britain having one of the largest betting markets and the most successful racing industries. Even Australia, which like Britain does not have a tote monopoly, returns five times as much back to the sport direct from betting turnover as is the case in Britain. It must be said, Britain instead relies on media rights agreements, whereby bookmakers pay the sport for the rights to show the racing and have the data. But as Richard says, these deals are opaque and they are likely to come under major pressure when they are up for renewal. But he says it's not just about the money returned to the sport, it's about where and how the sport chooses to spend it. And this is where I think his findings are incredibly interesting, because he shows that British prize money on the flat has actually grown 5% year on year over the last 30 years, equivalent to the growth of prize money in Australia. But, he highlights, while Australia's fixture list has contracted by 18% during that period, reflecting its own decline in the fall crop, Britain's has grown by 60%, delivering, as he says, ever diminishing returns. As a result, while top-tier prize money in Britain has kept pace with global standards, at the bottom end, prize money has dwindled and the returns to horsemen and owners are ever poorer. Killoran traces the rot to the 2004 Office of Fair Trade ruling, which shifted power from the BHP to the racecourses. Scott, tell us about what that did and how that has affected British racing's power structure.
I obviously spend quite a lot of time talking to administrators in other countries, and they are all very, very conscious of the fact that they have the power to write their own fixture lists. If they have, even in a jurisdiction like Hong Kong, where you have almost a fixed number of horses and you can import a certain number in a year, there's no breeding industry there, you can write a fixture list that accurately reflects the size of the racing population. In France, where I'm based, if there are fewer horses sold at yearling sales, if there are fewer horses in training, or if there's a certain grade of horse that comes under pressure, you can pull that lever, you can change the fixture list. There was some discussion earlier this year of specific kinds of conditions races being amalgamated, so you didn't have separate fillies and colts races, but you had them, if they were under a certain number of runners declared, you amalgamated the races. It was quite controversial, but it's something that is held with the central power. That 2004 OFT ruling basically gave upwards of 70% of the fixture list, nearly 80% of the fixture list, to the individual racecourses and racecourse groups. As Richard explains, the actual size of the fixture list in terms of the number of races has increased quite dramatically. You think about the increase of all-weather flat racing since 2004, with 21 years on now, whatever, it was still not quite in its infancy in 2004, but it was still a seen as a lesser part of the fixture list. It's now a very, very large part of the flat programme altogether. So even though prize money has gone up, the number of races has gone up exponentially. And so you're actually looking at a declining number of horses running for less prize money, as he points out, in terms of the yearling sales. A lot of horses are actually produced at a loss. Stallion fees are actually at a very high level at the moment. So again, it's this interconnectedness. But going back to that OFT ruling, if you see something is not working in terms of field sizes, betting turnover, it's very, very hard for the BHA to pull that lever, because they actually effectively only own about 20% of the fixture list. Now, in this spirit of new cooperation and Lord Allen trying to bang heads together, are some of those racecourse groups going to be prepared to sacrifice fixtures, have to try and bolster the product kind of in the way that they have in Australia? Or are they going to continue to fight their own corner because the media rights, you know, that they earn from those individual races is their basic business model? Because we don't know in a lot of ways what those media rights are worth, it will be difficult to find out when they come up for renegotiation how much they go down. But hopefully we'll, you know, independent racecourse executives will come to the party and sort of say this is now no longer part of the key part of our strategy.
This is the fundamental problem, is that what is good for racing holistically is not necessarily what is good for the racecourse groups that control the fixtures. As Richard puts it, the incentives in racing reward the next meeting, not the next decade. So if you are a racecourse group, and the largest racecourse group by volume of fixtures is Arena Racing Company, it is not in their interest to cut fixtures, because it comes directly off their bottom line on the media rights payments.
It's a case of whether people can be persuaded to look longer term and say, my business may suffer in the short term, but I will still have a business in 10 or 15 years. Mm. Whereas if this continues to become ultimately a less attractive betting product, if we get continued contraction of field sizes, if we have more of the best horses sold abroad, so we're watching a lesser product, does that then mean that the bookmakers are obviously under pressure from a regulatory point of view, potentially on taxation, definitely on affordability checks? If they become less engaged with racing and there is this continued decline on all fronts, do those racecourse groups that currently have an interest in preserving the fixture list as it is, do they have a business in 10 or 15 years' time?
And this is a central argument that Richard makes. He says, persisting with the status quo risks sleepwalking towards a breaking point. Carry on as we are, and the decisions will be taken out of racing's hand, and instead of shaping the fixture list, we will be dismantling it under duress. Yeah. The urgency that he is calling for, James, is immediate action.
It's basically what we are in the position we're in is a bit of Russian roulette, because the racecourses have these fixtures. Scott uses a very, very good word, is sacrifice, because they will have to sacrifice their fixtures and be confident they can make enough revenue from the other fixtures that they are left with. Now, given we have racing tax, given the affordability checks and the pressures that they're on, that's obviously not certain to necessarily make the revenue they need to. So it would be a case of sacrifice. The bookmakers, well, we know from the situation at Bath last season, the media rights deal, they don't particularly feel they're getting a good deal. Mm-hmm. And they're unsure, and they're calling the betting product isn't substantial. It's not making money for them. So they're in the other corner going, well, we're not sure about the racecourses are here. And then you've got the idea of the races and the fixture list itself, which aren't filling. And we talk a lot, there's a lot of detail in the report. One of the elements that I find most interesting about racing is that you want to encourage people to be a part of this sport. I mean, British racing, there are some great things, you know, the top tier of British racing still doing quite well, great. Mm. But if you're saying to people in the future and in 10 years' time, you should really get involved in British racing, it's a great thing to get involved with as an owner. How can you explain in any terms, so you buy a horse, it's going to cost you a fortune, and then you're running for about $4,000. You'd need to win about 12 races to really make some money back, or be a really good horse, and it's very unlikely. It's a hard sell. It's a really, really hard sell. Mm. And as you rightly say, we need to be thinking 10, 15 years ahead, because at it stands, British racing is just sinking and we're in this state of flux where someone has got to budge, but nobody seems interested.
Well, hopefully Richard's report causes people to think again. He says racing doesn't need evolution, it needs revolution. Do you agree? Read the full special report now on the Racing Post digital channels or in Tuesday's Racing Post. I'm sure we will return to this subject in the future and would very much like to hear your views at home. So please do comment and get in touch on our social channels. Gents, let's move on to the weekend action. It was quite an eventful weekend, and it was in your two patches. So
yeah, we've got flat jumps divide here.
No final. Where will we start? We will start. Let us start with the flat because that is the conclusion of the flat season. But it's still got life in the old boy just yet. Aidan O'Brien had quite a weekend. Managing to turn out more new classic favourites than most trainers would manage in a decade. First at Doncaster and then over in France. Talk us through it and your take on what unfolded.
You've got to feel a little bit sorry for Mountain Hawk, haven't you? He was Derby favourite for about 24 hours. He won the juvenile Derby trial, if you like. He won the same trial that Motivator won and Authorised won. And, you know, all these great horses from the past who've won that race and gone on to win the Derby. And he was favourite for 24 hours. And then Pierre Bonnard pops up at Saint-Cloud yesterday afternoon and wins the Critérium de Saint-Cloud. That's a double on the card for Aidan and for Christophe Soumillon. They've already had the winner of the Critérium International as well with Puerto Rico. He did the same double that Rafe Beckett managed with Angel Bleu back in 2021. I think it's actually quite unusual to run on Arc Day and then come back 3 weeks later and run in that race. It tends to be a bit of a sort of consolation race. And from a situation where you might have said, if we'd have been having this conversation straight after the Dewhurst, you'd say, okay, so Aidan's got a fantastic crop of two-year-old fillies. He's going to win the 1,000 and he's going to win the Oaks. But where are his colts? And now he's got the top three in the betting in the 2,000 guineas, or two of the top three in the 2,000 guineas. He's still got Albert Einstein waiting on the in the wings there. And he's got six of the top eight or something in the Derby. And you wouldn't know at this point which one of them is going to go to Epsom, which one's going to go to France, which one's going to wait for Ireland. I have to say the one that Christophe speaks the most fondly about is Pierre Bonnard. He's a massive fan of.
He's captured the imagination of a few people within this building as well.
Yes. I noticed even on Saturday evening on digital channels and in Sunday's paper, the kind of expert jury, although they were impressed with Mountain Hawk and they said don't give up on Benvenuto Cellini. Yeah, it was just they were already looking forward to Pierre Bonnard working on the Sunday, racing on the Sunday. Yeah. And there's just a lot to like about him. He's got a lovely way of going about him, and he doesn't have push button acceleration. But Christophe said afterwards, because he said, you know, I've just won two Group Ones without really coming off the bridle, without picking up the whip. And the phrase he used in French was quel chocolat. Which that's a very Belgian phrase, I suspect. Really, was you know, what a joy to be able to ride these great horses at his stage of his career. He's, you know, deep into his 40s. He's probably not got many more years like this, but he's making the most of it. He's having fun.
Well, it's a hell of a call up to get. Not a bad sub to call on as well for Aidan O'Brien. And of course, the narrative that's defining the end of his season is his pursuit of his own record for the most Grip or Grade Ones in a single season. He's now just three away from that record of 28. It seems a matter of when, not if, he passes it, potentially as soon as this weekend at the Breeders' Cup.
He could even do it Friday. He might not even have to wait for the main menu, could he? He could quite conceivably win the three turf juvenile races on Friday, and then he's level. But he's then got Mini Hawk is even money for the turf on Saturday, and even the hardiest Rebels Romance fan is going to be quite scared of her. She, you know, she reproduces anything like how she ran in the Arc on ground that's likely to suit her a lot better than the soft ground at Longchamp. She's going to be very, very hard to beat. He's got chances in the Filly Mare turf and in the mile as well. So, I mean, he could It never works out like this. He's not going to have six winners at the Breeders' Cup meeting, but he could easily have three or four.
Yeah.
And then that's without going to the Japan Cup and the Hong Kong International races at the end of the year. So I think he'll break it. It's a case of how hard he makes it for himself in the future. If he gets to like 31 or 32 or something like that, he's set himself quite the target to then break it in another 3 or 4 years' time when he has another great, great crop.
It's absolutely astonishing. And James, speaking of records, a man who is doing a very good impression of the ultimate record breaker, AP McCoy, Sean Bowen, who's absolutely lit up the beginning of the jump season.
He's been really off the scale, I have to say. I mean, if you'd had this conversation 2 weeks ago after Chepstow, I walked away from that meeting thinking, I knew this guy's clearly good. He's a champion jockey. But he's winning races he shouldn't be winning. Mm. And there's a case of that a few times this season. But it's his drive and its determination which is particularly big this season. I mean, he is going out of his way to get as many rides and as many winners as he wants. He will have half an eye on those McCoy records.
Yeah.
Let's not muck about. He is flying. 118 winners, was it 28% strike rate? I mean, I know he's probably had a lot of odds on shots through the summer, so it's possibly a tad inflated. But he is riding very well. And the interesting angle to Sean Bowen this season will be just how much interest the Irish trainers have of him coming into the spring festivals, because he has never ridden a Cheltenham Festival winner. It's the most amazing stat, really.
It's incredible.
That he never has. But he's always had support from Gordon Elliott. William Mullins doesn't miss a trick, and Sean Bowen's going to be getting good opportunities with Ollie Murphy, of course, but he's going to be available for some big rides around the season. And look, you would want him on your horse more than anybody else at the minute. He is absolutely staggering. So full credit to him, and I'd love to see how far he goes.
He's a brilliant rider, and of course, while he's got going in terms of the massive totals a little bit later in his career than AP McCoy, there is that one AP record that eluded AP, which is at 300 winners in a season, which he's pretty much on course to do. I mean, there's a hell of a long way to go between now and end of the season.
Sean put out a tweet saying he was thinking about one winner a day as a way of looking at it. And 118, I don't quite know how many days there's been since May, but I'd say he's on track. And like I say, he's not going to be short of opportunities. If he's got a chance to really do it, I think there are a lot of people that throw support behind him as well.
I had a question for you. You were there for both days at Cheltenham. Obviously, the big 100,000 handicap went the way of the Irish. We're kind of quite used to that.
Yeah, four of us first five home.
Exactly. We've got the Gordon Elliott stable tour in today's paper with David Jennings. How much of a bearing could Gordon have on the British Champions race if he has a really, really big year at home and makes Willie Mullins sort of just a little bit more domestic focused? Does that open the door slightly for a Dan Skelton or a Nicky Anderson or whatever, or is it just a case of Willie will send his second and third strings and he'll still mop up in the spring?
I think the power of Mullins is still pretty unprecedented. I mean, great result for Gordon. Gordon's got a lot of very good horses in the yard, but the strength and numbers that Mullins has at the minute, I'd be very wary that if he wants to dominate, he really can, and he can still have a really good period in Ireland, come to Cheltenham and still win a lot of races. Willie never really gets going until the November, December time, and it's always a case at this time of year where we go, oh, maybe Willie Mullins, he might not happen this year, and then come December and he's won every race at Leopardstown, he's won the King George. We begin to go, forget that, he's back. So I look at the strength that Mullins has, the amount of good runners he had at the Cheltenham Festival in terms of the positions in those novice races, the next generations. I think he's the ultimate force at the minute, and I would be very wary of saying he is going to be stopped. But no, it's a great winner for Gordon, free card brag. Max McNeil desperate to try and win the Grand National with him, but not quite sure what's happened. My takeaways from the meeting was really lovely story was Freddie Keefley, his first winner at Cheltenham. I think this is a kid to watch. He is seriously good.
I know, it made me feel old as well, because I remember his old man sort of.
We all do.
When his kids were going, because of course they often appear on social media and they've been in the winner's enclosure, and now he's riding horses, and it's one of those moments where you confront your mortality. And
I used to scratch my head and think, maybe these kids should be in school, but now I see him riding at Cheltenham, I'm like, okay, I'll let him off. And he beat Sean Byrne in the finish on a 22-1 shot. So Freddie Keefley, a man to watch this season.
And I think, speaking of the top meetings doing well, there was another record attendance for the showcase meeting.
Record attendance on Saturday, 21,000. Yeah. Really good buzz there. Big student day. All the students were in the best mates. The music was hammering the windows in the press room in the early as we were filing copy. But there's a buzz about Cheltenham. You know, we know there's a lot of changes made. There were cheaper pints to take advantage of, as we all well know. There was a buzz about being back at Cheltenham. Although, word on the ground about the Saturday at the Cheltenham Festival didn't seem very popular.
No, that one hasn't landed tremendously well. But you've got to consider new things.
Yeah.
Let's move on, because perhaps the biggest story last week, well, certainly one, the biggest story if you're considering the Anglo-Australian racing media as a whole, was Maureen Haggis versus Zach Purton. Now, this was fantastic. It electrified the sport. Maureen Haggis, in the most unlikely of surroundings of a Wednesday night fixture at Kempton, decided to drop several bombs where she described the ride Zach Purton had given Lake Forest at Randwick as, I will quote, "about the worst I've ever seen in my entire life. I was appalled, absolutely appalled." But then Purton shot back, which was fantastic, because he said he didn't actually speak to them after the race. She's got her opinion and she's entitled to it, but I haven't had the time to watch the replay because I've been busy watching myself win the $20 million Everest. How about that? More of this, please, eh?
More of this, definitely. It's not one I had on my bingo card at the beginning of last week, really, or even in the wake of Zach winning the Everest and Lake Forest running disappointingly in the King Charles III as well. That wasn't a race I watched back thinking this is going to be the race from that day that we're going to be talking about. I thought we might still be talking about Kai Ying Rising at this point. I will say there was quite a lot of the Australian and the Hong Kong media who were saying, well, she doesn't know who Zach Purton is, you know, and that's on her, on Maureen for being ignorant of the strength of the riding colony in Hong Kong and in Sydney, and you know, that's just old world, new world sort of ignorance, if you like. I think both William and Maureen, you have to give them an awful lot of respect, don't you? I mean, if you grew up as Lester Piggott's daughter, you know a bad ride when you see one.
Yeah.
And I think there's possibly, from those people on down there in Sydney, who, let's face it, they love a bit of Aussie Anglo wrangling anyway, but it's a nice warm-up for the Ashes, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that if you're going to say, well, look, you need to find out a bit more about Zach Purton, he's on his way to riding 2,000 winners in Hong Kong, he's broken Douglas White's record, he's broken every record going. Yes, he's a very, very well-established jockey who has ridden an awful lot of winners, made people a lot of money. Everybody's entitled to a bad day. And I think if, as a trainer or a trainer's assistant or whatever, you perceive that your horse has not been given the ride it should have done, and especially if they've travelled halfway around the world to do it, I think you've got every right to say something. The fact she chose to say in public on television is great for us. I think you want to see a bit more passion about these things. But as I say, some of the commentary I saw from Hong Kong and from Australia was a bit kind of like, well, who's Maureen Haggis anyway? She's not even the trainer, she's the assistant and all the rest of it. Let's have a bit of respect here. I think both she and William know a poor ride when they see one. It's not something maybe that if you or I are not intimately acquainted with Lake Forest and his running style in the way that they are, we might not have picked it. We might have watched it, might have seen the winner, might not really have noticed him falling out the back of the television. When you start watching it, he's not given a hard time. You can say, well, okay, his winning chance had gone because he didn't pick up straight away. He's not given a hard time. I think the trainer's got every right to say. Now, in an ideal world, you go and do that in a quiet corner of the parade ring and just make your feelings known when you book a different jockey the next time. But, I mean, she spoke to Lewis Porges, didn't she, over the weekend? They're not backing down on this.
No, she said, you know, oh, I want to move on. But then also she said, well, I stand by every word I said, and we're going to send Kieran Fallon down to
me. I'm enjoying the fact that both William and Maureen are, I think they've reached that stage of their career. They've trained a lot of very, very good horses. They've trained two of the best horses in training in Britain in the last 5 years. So they're getting to that stage of their career where they're, and I don't mean this in any way disparagingly, but they're kind of elder statesmen. And I think they are enjoying, when things come up that they don't don't like. William Haggas was on Nick Luck last weekend and was talking about a ride that Sheen Murphy gave a horse, which he ended up losing the race for in Sandown, and said that he felt the stewards don't come down hard enough on, he said specifically on a Sheen, but more generally on what he considers to be dangerous riding. I think they're just, they feel that they're at that stage of their career that if they've got something that is bothering them like that, they should be able to say it, and they've earned the right to air those opinions, and I say more power to them.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Let's keep it coming.
Couldn't believe it. I thought it was brilliant. I loved the drama of it. I think everyone loves a bit of drama. And I mean, it had 1.2 million views online. That clip.
Yeah.
I mean, it just goes to show that actually, even people outside of the little realms of racing and who perhaps aren't watching Kempston on a Wednesday night were invested in this story because it was so passionate. And I'm all for a bit of transparency and a bit of honesty about things like this, because as Scott rightly says, I mean, that horse was beaten. There would be frustrated punters about them. They'd be frustrated about how they've travelled. And they would have felt, watching that race, well, this isn't our fault. We didn't do anything. So they're going to stand up for themselves. And there's a lot of pride in racing. So I'm not surprised by that. I don't think it's a bad thing when the guard comes down and you say, this is exactly what I feel. You know, I know he came back a bit. I think wasn't one of his comments, I think Maureen's been on the drink.
Yeah, he did. He
really
did.
Quite.
That was his opening gambit.
Yeah, you know.
But that's kind of like, you know, the Australians do tend to be a lot more relaxed with this kind of thing. We can be a little bit more uptight, a little bit more cautious. And you know, if we get a little bit more straight shooting, then that's probably no bad thing, is it?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I hope this is the sort of stuff we see on Champions Full Gallop, because it would be an absolute seller if that's got, 1.2 million.
Well, absolutely. Gents, we have very little time left, but we can't leave without turning very briefly back to the Breeders' Cup at Del Mar Friday and Saturday. Very quickly, I have to say there's going to be a Breeders' Cup show broadcast Thursday, 8 a.m. in association with Blood Horse, with Anglo-American experts on it, running the rule over 2 days of fantastic action at Del Mar, where the surf meets the turf. What are you most looking forward to, James?
Well, I was going to say the Charlie Hall, but you put me in a corner.
No, that's fine. You could say the Charlie Hall.
It's Rebel's Romance. Yeah. Most favourite flat horse in training. Love to see him win. I know Mini Hawk's going to be tough, but I really hope he can upset her.
And yourself?
Well, we really are going to fall. It's a good job we're sitting on opposite sides of the sofa here, because I think Mini Hawk was... I'm a big fan of Darius, who beat her in the art. I think if she runs somewhere close to that... and. This is one of the underappreciated things about Aidan O'Brien, is how he turns these horses around and gets them out to run to the same level all the time, in a way that most other trainers would say, she's had a hard race in the art. Let's you know, that's her done for the year. You can be relatively sure she's going to light the ground. I just think she's a special talent. It might not even be her last run of the year. If Aidan's chasing this record, and he says he doesn't really mind about that, she's nominated for the Japan Cup, along with Los Angeles and a couple of others. She's easily the sort of horse that could go to Hong Kong as well. You know, you're not thinking of stalling careers or whatever, whether she stays in training next year or not. Yeah. She might actually be a bit of a flagship horse for the end of the season. So I'd love to see her run well. And purely from the point of view of my now very sad-looking anti-post bet on 2,000 guineas, I hope humidity runs very well on Friday in the juvenile turf.
Fantastic. Well, fingers crossed. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Brilliant show. Really appreciate your time. Thank you to you at home as well for joining us. And do stay tuned to the Racing Post all through this week, because we will have everything on the Breeders' Cup and indeed the Charlie Hall as well. Until next time, goodbye.